880 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock, time to jump here on Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is going to be talking about the economy of the United States and what sort of economy would better or best suit our purposes. He's got some provocative ideas talking about America beyond capitalism. Join us today for the full hour with Gar Alperovitz. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tavey.
When Congress voted last week to extend the payroll tax cut and unemployment benefits, they also passed another important provision for the public, opening up TV spectrum for unlicensed use. All wireless signals run on public airwaves, also known as spectrum. The bill allocates a chunk of these public airwaves for public or unlicensed use, rather than reserving it for exclusive or licensed use by big companies like AT&T and Verizon. Already, unlicensed spectrum powers up to 90% of iPad internet traffic and a growing proportion of overall internet traffic, as well as everyday gadgets like garage door openers, baby monitors, and remote controls. Matt Wood, policy director for Free Press, says access to more unlicensed spectrum allows internet companies to innovate and connect rural areas of the nation with high-speed broadband. One downside of the bill, however, is that it reserves a portion of spectrum for auction.
The bill is definitely a compromise. We would have liked to see more spectrum set aside for potential unlicensed use and for new and innovative companies to come in and develop new broadband business models using the public airwaves.
Wood is worried that the bill doesn't do enough to promote competition in the auctions, meaning companies like AT&T and Verizon could stockpile spectrum.
That spectrum then tends to go to a couple of incumbents that act as gatekeepers and that don't give people as much freedom and as much of an easy path to getting online. They try to monetize every last bit of it.
Still, Wood says there's much to celebrate, including the technological possibilities that come with more unlicensed spectrum.
It's hard to imagine a world where you had to be plugged into the wall to continue getting online, and so people have come to rely on Wi-Fi and other types of unlicensed spectrum access to extend the range of their broadband connection. The new uses for unlicensed spectrum that are still coming down the pipe from technology companies will allow for an even better sort of Wi-Fi, if you will, rather than just relying on having a contract with a carrier like AT&T, like Verizon.
Wood said Free Press will monitor the outcome of this bill and will continue to advocate for greater competition in the spectrum auctions. To find out more, visit freepress.net.
This May, Chicago will host both the G8 and NATO summits, and a city councilman wants to ensure that cell phones and the internet don't fall victim to any police shutdowns during these events. At a Chicago City Council meeting last week, Alderman Ricardo Munoz proposed an ordinance that would forbid the Chicago Police Department from cracking down on protesters and journalists by shutting down mobile towers, blocking mobile and web access, or jamming signals. Although there's been no indication that Mayor Rahm Emanuel or Police Chief Gary McCarthy plan to cut off communications, Munoz wants a commitment in writing. These are the first G8 NATO summits on American soil in the age of Twitter, and we want to be sure people are able to communicate, he said. The city council did not take action on the proposal, and neither Emanuel nor McCarthy have embraced the idea. LightSquared had big plans for injecting more competition into the wireless market. The company wanted to use a hybrid of on-the-ground base stations and satellite service to create an open network that would provide phone and internet service with 4G connections. But those plans soured this week when the Federal Communications Commission informed LightSquared that it would prevent the network from launching. The FCC had granted conditional approval to LightSquared, pending the results of testing by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. But the NTIA's report said LightSquared's plan would interfere with GPS devices, including those navigation systems found in airplanes and boats. But here's the rub. It's not that light-squared signals are bleeding outside their own spectrum. It's that the GPS devices have not upgraded to the latest technologies and pick up signals from neighboring bands. LightSquared is calling for GPS manufacturers to fix the flaws in their devices, but the FCC evidently is not willing to force the GPS industry to retrofit its devices to better filter signals. Meanwhile, LightSquared figures prominently in a political battle on Capitol Hill between FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski and Iowa Senator Charles Grassley. Last October, President Obama nominated two people to replace retired FCC Commissioner Michael Copps and former Commissioner Meredith Atwell Baker, who resigned last spring to work as a Comcast lobbyist. Grassley won't allow the nominations to proceed until the FCC gives him documents relating to the conditional approval granted to LightSquared. He believes the agency initially showed favoritism towards the company, and even though the FCC halted LightSquared's plans after receiving the new NTIA report, Grassley isn't backing down, forcing the FCC to continue with only three commissioners. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 26, 2012, here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today, someone I've been wanting to have on the show for a while, Gar Alperovitz, is the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland. He's a historian, a political economist, has written numerous books going all the way back to 1965. His newest book, which is just released in a second edition, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, is getting a lot of attention. And we're going to be talking about it today on the show. Gar Alperovitz, welcome to Media Matters.
Glad to be with you, Bob.
Well, let's start, if we can, Professor Alperovitz, with just talking a little bit about the title of the book and what the point of the book is. America Beyond Capitalism, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is capitalism something we should be eager to keep, or is it something we need to get past?
Well, I think we are moving past, there's a lot of groundswell, many, many different kinds of institutions that are beginning to suggest that we are going to be moving beyond traditional capitalism, and I think also beyond traditional socialism as well. So, yes, I think it's a good thing. I think that the way the economy's been running and the power of the wealthy and the large corporations to dominate both economic decision-making and politics has been disastrous in recent years. And I'm, I look at it both as a political economist and as a historian, and I suspect that this system that we're living with now is certainly not the last system in history. We're likely to move on, and I think there's some positive things showing that.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, please correct me if I'm wrong, if you look back at the great political economists that we think of in the founding of the modern field of economics, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, even through to Keynes, they all had sort of a historical sense that this was a system that would exist for a while, but it wasn't the last resting space for the human race.
I think that's a very important perspective. Modern economy and economics is very narrowly focused, and it assumes that what you see is what you get forever. That just isn't the way the world looks when you look at it in terms of long, long paths of history. And John Stuart Mill, for instance, Karl Marx, of course, all of the great historical economists understood evolution. Even Keynes began to see a different vision beyond capitalism.
And one of the points you make, you go through your book, you talk at some length laying out the case against existing contemporary capitalism, the problems with it, and why they're pretty much insurmountable within the system. One of the points you make, and I think it's one that is resonating more and more, is the notion that contemporary capitalism is marked by a deepening stagnation that really is going to define it going forward. Can you talk a little bit about that, since it's such a central point to making your case?
Yes, and it's a critical understanding, because we've often had a kind of polarity of thinking about the economy. Traditional liberalism, for the most part, and I have some experience in that world myself, has a kind of view that we have cyclical changes. There's a recession, then there'll be an upswing and a recession, and it's kind of like the pendulum will always swing. Traditional Marxism, but not Marx himself in certain areas, it's very unclear in certain areas, believed there would be a massive crisis collapse that would totally produce a revolution. And indeed, that may very well be in many countries. The possibility that we might have something that was neither of the above, ongoing deepening stagnation with occasional ripples up and down around a stagnating trend, that possibility, I think, is the one that defines most likely the emerging era. One way to think about it is this. During the 1930s and the great collapse of the Great Depression, the underlying floor, the government floor under the economy, was about 11% of the gross national product. It is currently, now it depends on where the denominator of the fraction is with the recession, it's currently in the 30% range. So there is an underlying sustaining capacity. That doesn't mean you can grow or that you get full employment. It means that it's very hard to get the classical collapse of traditional theory. And an ongoing period of growing pain, of decay, of unemployment and underemployment, of poverty, of dislocation, over a long stretch of time is very different than a sudden collapse in terms of its political implications, and different, too, from the idea that we're going to upswing and everything will be fine with a traditional revival along hopeful Keynesian and liberal lines. And I think that that context does define a context in which slowly and agonizingly people begin to take charge in different ways, starting where they live, starting locally where they work, starting in different ways to begin to generate a different political and institutional possibility. So I think that's a possibility, no more. We can't conclude an inevitability. But a long period of development, I think in some ways has many, many negatives, great pain. But in some ways, it allows people to really develop a different vision and also different experience, whereas a sudden collapse often ends up in the hands of small elites. So a possibility of a democratic reconstruction, or what I sometimes call an evolutionary reconstruction, though agonizing and painful, also teaches people to, for instance, build worker-owned companies and how to run them, and co-ops and neighborhood-owned industries, and get direct experience over time that's not possible when you have a sudden collapse.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to Professor Garel Purovitz, author of the new book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. The phone number here, if you'd like to speak with the professor, is 217-333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Professor Purovitz, I want to get into the guts of your book, which is precisely that, the sort of emerging alternative or new economy that is developing at the local level, especially in the United States, and the promise for the future. But let's, before we get to that point, a couple of things. A short point first. You talked about how the role of the government in the U.S. economy has increased from roughly 10 or 11% 80 years ago to 30, 35% today. And I think anyone who just tuned into this show but follows American politics will think it's interesting that the major issue that all Republican candidates for president, and no small amount of sympathy from the Democratic side, is that the federal government role, or the government role in general, is way too large in our economy. And that's the central problem of our economy. And if we just lick that one and get the government shrunk down and put back in its cage, that the economy will then blossom again. What's your take on that analysis?
Well, it's very interesting if you come at it from that. That is the way in which the political debate is structured in the national arena, just as you said. Cut back, don't raise taxes, or raise more taxes on the top groups. Back and forth that debate goes. And I suspect we're going to get some of both. I think we will get some elite taxation, hopefully some, the top 1%, and we'll get some cutbacks. But if you stand back from it, what's really interesting is that on the really big funding areas in Social Security, but above all Medicare, the constituencies that will refuse major cuts are very, very powerful, even against the Republicans. So there's a lot of railing at Medicare costs, which are going to increase over time, and Social Security costs. But I suspect the politics of that isn't going to work very well, even for the Republicans, which the bottom line being that, yes, there may be some cutbacks, but not of the order that take us back to those 10 and 11% of GDP ratios of the government to the economy. There's still going to be a very large floor.
One of the things I took away from your book, Professor Alperovitz, was that, it's technically or theoretically possible that our economy could be turned around with Keynesian policies and astute use of government spending and taxation to create a green economy and full employment and all sorts of good things. But politically, that's not very likely because of the corruption of the system and the complete dominance of the political process by wealthy interests that are not interested in going that direction. Is that a fair summation of your argument?
Yes, I would add one thing to it, but it's an extremely important kind of stepping off point to think about the future, that because many progressives kind of rally the troops, hope there will be a kind of rebound or the pendulum will swing, as the late Arthur Schlesinger Jr. held. And what that kind of general rhetoric really covers up is a loss of analysis. The really big thing that's happened in the Democratic politics, and it's a politics that I used to be deeply involved in both the House and Senate, the really powerful thing is the collapse of the American labor movement. Labor unions have been, tragically, they have been the muscle, not only on the shop floor, but in politics, in all of the advanced systems that allow for a progressive or social democratic politics to work. And they've gone from about 34.5% at the peak in the early 50s, to now at the 11 to 12% range, and in the private sector, 6.9% at the latest numbers, and declining, which means not only that they're weak at the shop floor and in the bargaining with the against the governors in Ohio and Indiana and Michigan and what we're seeing all over the country, they also lose the power to really demand a powerful Keynesian program to solve major economic problems. So that, I think, is perhaps the most important single factor that's undermined a traditional Keynesian solution.
So what's the way out?
Well, I look at it as a historian, and I sometimes say that, which I deeply believe, my kind of heroes are the people working in Mississippi on civil rights issues in the 1930s and 40s, many in the 1960s when everything broke open in the 1950s. But laying groundwork, though, that's when the hard work had to be done. Laying groundwork for the days when there could be a really major shift. And I think that's what's really interesting about our time. If you see it historically, there are lots of things developing, and the most important parts of which, and this is what, is the essence of the argument of America Beyond Capitalism, the most important part of this is changing ownership of capital and wealth, both in the real world, but also in the idea system we all work with. So long as you kind of think, well, the corporations are going to control all the wealth, and then we can reform them, tax them, or regulate them, they've got the power base. Systems, historically, political economic systems, revolve largely around who owns property. Feudalism, it was land. In 19th century capitalism, it was small businessmen, mostly farmer businesses. In the state socialist or, quote, communist, unquote, systems, the state owned the major property. Well, what's interesting is that the beginnings of a vision that involves radical decentralization, but also change in ownership of wealth, is beginning to emerge largely out of pain, largely out of the failures. 1% of society today in America owns 50, just under half of all of the investment capital, all the factories, the farms, the mines. 1% owning almost half, 5% has 70%. The top 400 people, this is the most staggering figure, I didn't believe it until I checked it out several times, 400 Americans, 400 individuals, own more wealth than the bottom 60% of the society. You cannot have a democratic society if that continues. What's interesting is you're seeing changes in ownership in the real world that are teaching people that's not the only way to go forward. There's something like 10 or 11,000 worker-owned companies of one kind or another that changed the ownership of capital for roughly 13 million workers. About 5 or 6 million more people are involved than are workers involved in unions. That teaches in some sense that there are other ways to own capital, own wealth. There are 130, 140 million people involved in co-ops and credit union co-ops. Again, a democratization of wealth. There are 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood-owned corporations around the country. There are a number of states that are doing very interesting things. Roughly 15 states directly own parts of companies now. And, of course, in Alaska, they distribute oil revenues to the citizenry. Unlike Texas, the revenues go as a matter of legal right. So you find experiments all over the country, which America Beyond Capitalism lays out. And I do not see these now as the answer. What's really interesting is that because of the pain levels, people are beginning to be forced to develop different ways of doing things. They don't involve expenditures of public money because you can't get that. And the only answer then becomes either we develop something new, and the way you develop it has to do with ownership or a politics of ownership, or the conditions worsen. I could go on some very interesting things going on in Ohio.
Well, before we do, Professor Alperovitz, let me just reintroduce you to our listening audience. My guest today, Gar Alperovitz, a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, a former congressional aide who worked for Gaylord Nelson, the esteemed senator from Wisconsin at one point, and author of numerous books, including the new book we're talking about today in the program, America Beyond Capitalism. The phone lines are open here at Media Matters, the number 217-333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. America Beyond Capitalism has received ringing endorsements from all over the country, from people like Juliet Shore, the late Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, and others. I've had the privilege of reading it, and it really is a phenomenal read and a provocative book. Professor Alperovitz, you were just about to talk about Cleveland. I'm a native of Cleveland. You're from Racine, Wisconsin. And when I was a young man, and when you were a young man, the Midwest, the Great Lakes region, was filled with scores of cities, some large, that were quite wealthy by historical standards, based largely around manufacturing. Many of those cities are dying now, or seem to be dying, and they're just small shadows of what they were in 1955 or 1965. And your book talks a lot about those sort of towns, the towns that you and I grew up in, specifically Cleveland. What's happening in Cleveland that interests you?
Well, several things, but let me preface it by saying there is a really interesting 30-year developmental pattern in the state of Ohio that led to Cleveland, led to the experiment I'm about to describe, and this is not the last step. So the idea of evolving, let me just say a word about that. The first major steel closings, I worked with the steel workers in Youngstown, Ohio in the late 70s. The Youngstown Sheet and Tube went down. 5,000 people lost their jobs. That was a big deal in those days. It's very common now. And there was an attempt to build a worker-owned steel mill there, which got a huge national publicity and got support of politicians on all sides, and finally was undercut by the corporations and, I think, the International Union at that point. The union has since changed its position. All over the state of Ohio, over 20 to 30 years, starting there, people began to think more about worker ownership and how to do it. And there are probably more worker-owned companies per capita in Ohio coming from that experience than perhaps any place else in the country. So partly what's happened, and this is the story of Cleveland, is not simply that these strategies may answer a problem in a particular company, but in the sense of a Gramscian penetration of the ideological hegemony, to use that language, in a way that new ideas are generated and introduced into the consciousness. These experiences make it possible to imagine a different future and a different way of going forward at the level of ideas and ideology. So, for instance, 30 years later in Cleveland, you find a collective group of worker-owned co-ops, very sophisticated co-ops, organized there not simply to make the workers in each particular co-op wealthy, but they're linked together with a revolving fund and a nonprofit corporation. The goal is to rebuild the community, not just the workers. So it's much larger, broader, communal and communitarian, as well as worker ownership vision. And the next piece that's very interesting, and these are evolutionary, and I think we'll go beyond this in further experiments. Indeed, I know that's already happening in several other cities. The other piece is, in Cleveland, part of the kind of the remnants of the era you were talking about, Bob, about when the big companies were there, Cleveland had more, I think, had more companies in the Fortune 500 headquartered in Cleveland than any other city in the country in the 1950s. it's obviously gone from about 800,000 to less than 400,000 people now, so it's very different. But one of the residues of that was there was a huge health care industry built up around the big profits and the worker health programs that went along with those companies. So big hospitals, the Cleveland Clinic is one of the biggest known and university hospital there. They also exist in some of these cities. They also have a lot of public money, Medicare, Medicaid, and universities have a lot of public money, and they also are there, so-called anchor institutions. They can't get up and leave the way many corporations can. Well, what's interesting in the evolving thinking that's gone on, that's almost a quasi-public sector in Cleveland. In the particular neighborhood that we're talking about, there are about 40,000 people, these hospitals and universities purchase $3 billion, not million, billion dollars in goods and services every year, plus their salaries, plus their investment and construction budgets, just procurement, $3 billion, none of which, until now, has gone to the area. Well, the interesting model that's evolved there is the use of some of that procurement. They've gotten the hospitals and universities to agree to buy some of it from worker-owned companies that are building up the community simultaneously. So it's a very interesting model, both of changing ownership and of changing the way in which ownership relates to the market, in this case a quasi-public market that gives some stability to the actual working firms. Worker-owned companies on their own floating in the capitalist sea have a lot of problems. Floating in a sea that is partly managed and partly stabilized is a very different proposition, both from the point of view of driving them to compete and also from the point of view of ecological growth stability matters. So there's a big solar installation company that's about to put in more solar installation than exists in the entire state of Ohio, again, worker ownership. There's a large industrial-scale laundry that is probably the greenest in the Midwest. It uses about a third the water and heating that any other laundry would use, and again, pays much more than most laundries do, a very low-paid industry, but this laundry pays much better, starts at $10 an hour. There's they're just about to open up a very large, partly solar kind of supported greenhouse capable of producing 3 million heads of lettuce a year. These are not small businesses. They're really beginning to develop, and they're aiming to develop scale along this model. What's important is you're beginning to see these are, and all of them are green, you're beginning to see different models etched out in public that people can get a hold of and begin to think about for both in their community. There are about 10 cities that I know of already now are trying to do the so-called Cleveland model, but also beginning to give a vision of how we begin to think about the relationship of the market to ownership, and a vision that could begin to inform different models of systemic change over the long haul as the idea system begins to evolve and develop and become more refined.
Well, the phone lines have filled up, Professor Alperovitz, so let's get to our callers. Our guest again today, who you've just been listening to, Professor Gar Alperovitz from the University of Maryland, where he's a professor of political economy, and he's the author of the new book we're talking about, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's start with line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm actually in the midst of reading America Beyond Capitalism right now, and besides being fascinated by its comprehensive or sort of coherent vision, I find it very pragmatic and practically oriented. And I'm curious in the parallels in some ways between Cleveland and Champaign-Urbana. Of course, Cleveland's at least four or five times bigger, but we have a major university, a large regional community college, and we have a clinic here that at least has pretensions of being a Cleveland clinic, perhaps on a smaller scale, and Carle Hospital Foundation. How would a community like ours go about practically getting, you know, adopting the Cleveland model? How did it start? How did the practical things of getting that off the ground over a place like this?
Yeah, thank you very much, caller. Gar Alperovitz?
Well, let me answer it in two ways. First, I want to emphasize this term practical. you know, people on the left have often had a great deal of theoretical work and a great deal of important theoretical work and also rhetoric. But the notion of really getting serious and asking, how's it going to work? What's it look like? If you can do that next level of work, then you can talk to anybody about what you're talking about. We find in not only in Cleveland, but in many parts of the country, really explaining this is how it's work, it should work, and this is how it is working, and being able to answer the tough questions gets you beyond all kinds of crazy rhetorical debates and opens up the possibility of really transforming ownership in a very powerful way. Just to answer about what could be done, I mean, I think the first step is in any community is kind of pulling together a group of folks who think it's important to do. I'll give you a website where there's a lot of information on it, www.community-wealth.org. Community-wealth.org, which filled with information on it. So gathering and then beginning to ask what's appropriate in this town and how would we replicate it is one of the first steps. In Cleveland, we're much further along because Cleveland was the first one. And it was harder to, this idea seemed crazy to most people in some parts of the country. It doesn't any longer. Many, many cities that were, you know, we've been in the Democracy Collaborative, which is at the University of Maryland, which I helped co-found, has been working in Cleveland quite a lot. We've been kind of inundated with requests in Atlanta, from Pittsburgh, from many other parts of the country, even a couple cities in Texas are trying to develop this kind of a model. So we're going to see a lot more of it, and I'm sure better models and more improvement as time goes on. In Cleveland, it was in early days, and a meeting was called. I mentioned earlier that there are all kinds of democratized forms emerging around the country, and they're also at that website, community-wealth. The co-ops is one form, worker-owned companies, neighborhood corporations. There are 2,000 municipal-owned utilities, another democratized form. 25% of American electricity is socialized, utilities under co-ops and municipalities. There are land trusts, nonprofit or city-owned. So there are many, many, many forms, and America Beyond Capitalism tries to report on some of this, that all share the principle of a transformation of ownership and begin to give concrete meaning to that term. Well, in Cleveland, there was a meeting called and representing these various areas of folks working in these different things with, in some sense, a common principle. And out of that, a lot of discussions and then a lot of very detailed work. Could we apply some of this here, and how would it work? For instance, some of the folks involved did literally 140 interviews with procurement officers at these hospitals and universities, the guys who actually make the decision about what they're going to buy tomorrow. And it turns out that most of them were sympathetic, but they had they didn't know what they were, where they would buy if they didn't buy from the usual supporters and usual suppliers. But also there wasn't any capacity in many parts of this very poor community. So working in great detail, this is hard stuff. That's why I go back to these Mississippi. It's not dangerous, but it means the hard place is hard work. What do you buy? Could you buy it here if there were a company? Would you buy it here if there were a community-owned company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And developing the nitty-gritty of what it takes to make something real on the ground, and also beginning to build community support for it. There's a political and social aspect to it as well. I think it's going to be different in every community, and I think it's going to get better and more advanced. And, you know, I see these, and just let me back off and say it again, I see these as a historian and political economist. I'm not only interested in locality. The question is whether the planning principles and the ownership principles begin to sketch what could be done at larger scale, national and regional corporations, ultimately under different forms of ownership. But learning enough in some of these models and building a politics with enough real meat and potatoes, real knowledge in it and detailed knowledge, so that we have a different political vision at the higher levels as well when the time comes.
I guess as I hear you talk, Professor Alpervitz, that you want to develop a critical mass just so the institutions have support around them and also some political muscle, because I can just see already that there are going to be political fights, because there are going to be powerful commercial interests that aren't going to necessarily be sympathetic to this movement. And I think of two things I'd like you to comment on before we go to our next caller. First of all, You know, there's been an effort in a number of communities around the country that have lousy broadband internet service to set up municipal Wi-Fi systems that anyone in the community can use, high quality, low cost. And the cable and telephone corporations have used their immense political power and state governments to try to make these illegal, outlaw them, just so they can't exist, because they know that if they've been hard-pressed to compete with a municipal-run broadband system like a public utility. And secondly, I'd like to comment on the Green Bay Packers, you know, this extraordinarily successful community-owned team that's so successful that all the other sports leagues, including now the NFL, make it illegal, or they outlaw the ability of communities to have that sort of ownership, you know, because they see how successful it is. It sort of undermines their whole system.
Absolutely. You're right on target. There are many areas. There are going to be fights in many areas, just of the kind you're talking about. A scenario that is serious about rebuilding, or what I call evolutionary reconstruction, over time is clearly not going to just simply be an add-up of one small laundry and a solar installation company to take on all these fights. One of the things we have learned, however, is that in many communities, there is a potential coalition that looks different from the traditional one. What's interesting about some of these communities, you find that you get radical activists, you get religious people, you get the universities and the nonprofit institutions. You can make the mayor look good because he begins to get jobs that stay in the community. Even the small businessmen locally get an improvement of their market when you stabilize jobs. So they are not the same as the giant corporations. And so there is a potential politics that starts at these levels and begins to build over time to a different level, we think. That doesn't mean you're going to be able to knock down every opponent or change the rules of the game right now. We are in a very early phase of the development. But what we think we see is a different potential for developing a much, in locality after locality, very different politics and political alliances. Even taxpayers, and this is really interesting, because the main argument that's been brought up in many cases is that, you know, they try to pit the taxpayers against the social programs, obviously. Well, reconstructing the tax base by using policies that rebuild ownership and that don't come in like a corporation and run away after taking huge bribes from the government. There is even a politics that brings together the interests of the vast majority and begins to deal with some parts of the tax issue. I just did a piece that's out in the Baltimore Sun and all over in the McClatchy newspapers about many, many cities as well are making money out of community ownership. It's very common. 400 or 500 cities, for instance, capture methane from the garbage and turn it into money and energy and also reduce the methane, climate change, and jobs. So many cities are beginning to see that they can change the politics by changing the ownership strategy rather than simply regulating and taxing. To get to the question of where you can actually deal with the powerful issues you rightly raised, the Green Bay Packers or what's going on in terms of cable and different capacities for media, as I said earlier, I'm a historian. I do not see that we're going to win all the battles at one fell swoop. The question is whether we can begin to see a developmental path, even as labor unions, the institutional base of traditional progressive strategy, decline. If we can really begin community by community developing the institutional basis over time so that there's a new power base for politics, a power base that either can countervail against corporate influence, either stabilize and improve on the progressive strategy, or hopefully over a long haul lay down a vision and theory and the outlines and the politics of a systemic transformation. Obviously, I favor whether the latter, but even achieving new counterweight at the local and state and regional and national level by building up new institutions and displacing others would be a very important gains.
We have some callers who have been waiting very patiently to talk with Professor Gar Alperovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air.
How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had two questions for you, the first of which you addressed somewhat as I've been waiting to speak, but I'll try to put it succinctly. It seems to me that we've got two parties now, the Republican Party that looks to sort of The model is liberate the commercial sector from the state and the Democratic Party that wants to regulate the commercial sector, but in both cases, commercial sector is understood as corporate. It seems like what you're outlining is a more civil society, community-oriented, cooperative commercial sector that would be encouraged and facilitated by the state. And I wholeheartedly support that model. What sort of breaks my heart is that I think a lot of people backing the Republican Party or more conservative politics also are looking to support a model like that when they harken back to the individualism of the founding of this republic, et cetera. But we don't have a vision to talk about what you're talking about in a succinct way that can reach that sector of people. And I'm wondering if you think that there is a better rhetorical strategy that we can use that would be able to draw those people over, because as we know, if you talk about something like socialism or beyond capitalism, what that invokes in the average mindset is certainly not, I think, what you're trying to talk about in this book and today on the program. And the second question that I have is about the model specifically that you're talking about. Community ownership, it seems like you're talking about still within a market structure. And in the history of our country, we know that some sectors have started with community ownership, and that was taken over by larger corporations. The telephone sector is one. And so even if we had, say, municipal broadband ownership, how would we prevent that from reverting back to the sort of monopoly capitalist structure that has occurred since then?
Boy, those are great questions. Thank you very much, caller. Professor Alperovitz?
They are very good questions. Let me take the first one first about rhetoric. You know, I think that the progressives and the left in general have really missed an opportunity because they've stayed at the level of abstraction. And I think we haven't forced ourselves to say, if you don't like state socialism and you don't like corporate capitalism, really what is it you're talking about? And I think we've been, you know, people have been mushy about that. And therefore, what you get is the word socialism. By the way, the latest polling data shows young people under 30 are slightly more favorable to the word socialism than is negative. It's more positive than negative. And also, the word capitalism in general is not strongly supported by the broad public. It's about 50% to 40% who see capitalism as negative. There's really interesting polling data, both Rasmussen and Pew, on both of these subjects. And the groups that are going to make the next politics, young people, people under 30, the growing important group, that's where you see positives on socialism. So even that old rhetoric of the Cold War era doesn't have the same power that it used to have. But anyway, as to rhetoric, my experience is if you actually begin to get really clear in your own mind about what it is you're talking about, and as we've talked mainly about communities, but it needs to be extended, as I try to do in America Beyond Capitalism, both not there and in the new introduction and in the theoretical note, to nation and region. If you really get clear about it, like the Bank of North Dakota is operating for 90 years and it gives you an idea of a public bank, I find that you can talk to many, many, many more people. I come from Racine, and I have some old friends back in Racine, very conservative, kids I went from kindergarten to high school with, but still good friends, very conservative, very smart, very moral in some religious sense. And if you can talk practically about what it is you mean, these ideas don't have the same valence you think they do. They are, in fact, there's a positive reaction to them. They're the kind of people who voted in the last elections, you know, even for the famous liberal senator from Wisconsin, conservatives voted for him because he was a man of integrity, they said. And so I find that you can have a different dialogue if you know what you're talking about. The rhetoric doesn't go anywhere because it immediately gets you back into Stalinism and Red Scares. Concrete things are important, and I think that's our problem, not theirs. So I think we've got a lot of work to do, and if we do it, my experience is you can have a very different conversation, particularly at the local and state level. That is to say, at the national level, it's covered, the debate's all in ideological terms and abstractions, but where the real work has to be done, community by community, state by state, is building up a different politics and a different way of talking about it, and that means getting really tough-minded about it. So your second, I mean, I don't know if that answers your
question. Yeah, I think that was an excellent answer. The second part was concerning whether cooperatives in a sort of capitalist economy basically become capitalist institutions, even if they're worker-owned, because of market pressure.
certainly if nothing further changes, that's likely to happen. But notice carefully what the design structure in Cleveland is. And let me repeat it. There's an attempt to attempt in that community to begin to use quasi-public institutions. They're nonprofit institutions heavily dependent on taxpayer money, hospitals and universities, to begin to create a more stable market. And a market and a community where the politics begins to support that rather than reject it, because it builds the community, builds the tax base, even helps small businessmen in the area. So really thinking that through begins to give you an answer in cities like Cleveland and else. When some big company comes in from California and wants to take over the solar market, here's a community firm that's doing sophisticated work, that is efficient, that knows what it's doing, but is also building the community, has got the backing of the mayor and the city council, has got the backing of the big institutions like the hospitals and universities, and does an equally good job because the structure works that way. You're not just, as in, you know, small business development for minorities, you might make one or two guys rich and they run off to the suburbs. This structure is about building the community and the workers and the politics of that area. So it's a very different way of thinking about it, and you can't answer whether or not this is going to build up to be powerful enough to resist the tremendous pressures in the capitalist sea to be taken over or being run over or being destroyed. But there is a strategy attempting to really rebuild community by community so it isn't being isolated one by one so they can be picked off. It's an attempt to build community support in the very largest sense. One of the things that was kind of, just to give you a feel for this, it's gotten, as I say, Cleveland's the most advanced model, but there are going to be models that go beyond it. They opened, when they did the groundbreaking for this big greenhouse, the one that's going to produce about 3 million heads of lettuce a year, what you had is the high school band playing and the kind of cheerleaders, and the feeling of it is community, not just this guy's going to make some money, or it has a larger, different valence and sense of, and it should have, because that's the goal.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting very patiently to speak with our guest, Professor Garl Perowitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism. Let's go now to line 4, Coles County. You're on the air, and thank you for your patience.
Yes. I have read of similar changes that have been mentioned today and other changes similar to it. And I, of course, support them. I've noticed that I would guess that maybe 50 to 75% of these major changes that are being proposed, of the kind that he mentioned, involve some kind of governmental action, either by local governments and or state governments and or the federal government. And it involves often action by governments, often fairly radical action by governments. And in spite of that, I've noticed that most young activists, including most of the Occupy Wall Street people, disdain politics, disdain elections. They don't seem to have any interest at all in registering people to vote, and in fact don't have any plans to vote even themselves. And, of course, considering politicians to all be reactionary and so on and worthless, and they might be right about that, but in my opinion, if that doesn't change and the activists don't start registering people to vote as a high priority, there's going to be a real, real problem. Because most of these major changes, I would say at least a majority of them, not all, but most of them, involve some kind of action that's necessary at the governmental level by elected government officials. So these people better wake up pretty quick and realize that they need to vote.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Garl Perowitz, any comments?
Yes, a couple thoughts about it, because I think what the caller is talking about is real. But I also think that, you know, the way I look at these questions, that the ball always ends up in our court. That is to say, under the current strategies that are now available, there is so much corruption in Washington, either that is a corporate corruption and inability to deal with the banks and the big corporations. I don't mean there's also direct corruption. I mean political corruption, that it is not unreasonable to be cynical about the processes of current election. You know, the former so-called red mayor of London once wrote a book with the title, If elections mattered, they wouldn't have them. Now, that's an exaggeration. way exaggerated, because elections do matter, and I'd certainly rather have the Obama administration than what's brewing and percolating on the right now. However, the real question becomes, if politics that in your real experience begins to offer a vision and direct action and something that makes sense, really makes sense, in a new direction, then I think you'll begin to see people register and vote. There was a moment when thousands, millions of people began in the Obama era to come out for him, young people. But we're finding in the local areas the same thing beginning to happen, that beginning to sense a new direction locally that also involves city, state, and federal support begins to give people a handle on why politics matters and why there might be a different way forward given all the cynicism. So I think that's the task of building up a pathway in the midst of, you know, really, really good reasons to be skeptical about government action, building a path community by community and laying the groundwork that goes forward and undercuts that and indeed makes meaningful politics meaningful.
Professor, we've got a bunch of callers who've been lined up here. I want to get to all of them if we can in sure. The next 7 minutes. So let's just rush through the callers if we can. Line two, you're on the air with Professor Garel Purovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. The Republicans keep talking about big government. Now, a community-owned organization may start out efficiently, but it might tend to grow and grow and grow. Do you have any ideas on how community ownership can be can stay efficient and not rely on taxpayer as becoming more of a burden?
Well, that's a great question, and I suspect, Professor Alpervitz, that's really a central question that everyone asks.
Well, the answer is, if you look at public utilities, there are 2,000 electric utilities in the country that have been studied to death. These are socialized industries. On balance, they're more efficient. They put money into the treasury of the city. They don't take money out. The salaries are one-tenth at the top level of private corporations. They benefit the ratepayers. We know a lot more about the efficiencies. All the things I've talked about in Cleveland are not subsidized. These are not dependent upon some government subsidy. So if workers have participation and ownership, all the studies show that productivity goes up and efficiency goes up. I think the model has an inherent capacity to deal with the problem you're raising, and I think that the more we learn about it, the more we develop, the better we're able to go down that track.
So when cities privatize their public utilities, and governments do at whatever level, they basically get a lot of cash in the short term to help them immediately, but eventually down the road it's a clunker as a rule that they're going to end up paying out a lot more?
Absolutely, and it's been studied. And in fact, there's a lot of resistance now. The talk about it is overplayed. There's a lot of resistance in many communities already to the privatization argument, both of services but also of things like turnpikes.
Let's go now to line three. You're on the air with Professor Garel Purovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, I want to ask the professor if he is familiar with Henry George, who was a kind of a proto-populist, and if so, what's your take on him?
Henry George was a very interesting figure at the end of the 19th century, almost became mayor of New York City, sold probably more books than anybody else in his argument. Henry George argued rightly and without doubt correctly that land values increase because of the community, and that the real, in a city for instance, you build a house out in the country that costs you $50,000, you build the same house in the middle of the high-end suburbs, and it sells for $500,000 or a lot more. Why? Because land values go up, not the construction cost. The construction's exactly the same in both cases. And he pointed out that increase in value from $50,000 to $500,000 is all created by the fact of the community being there, nothing more. So the community created the wealth. It ought to, he argued, have a single tax to take it back. Well, many cities, and here's another piece of what's going on, again, you got to penetrate below the radar. Many cities now are setting up land ownership by the city to capture such increases in many different areas. For instance, used to be that cities would invest in mass transit, and at the exits of the mass transit, values of property go up, and they'd try to tax it back from the developer. now in many, many cities, and again, this isn't publicized, but it's very well documented, many cities say, hey, why don't we own it by the city? Municipal ownership will capture a lot more money than give it away to the developers. So there's a process that picks up on Henry George's point, but essentially does it through public ownership rather than attempting to tax back the powerful interests you create. You create real estate interest, then you can't tax it back. If you begin to displace them by public ownership or nonprofit ownership, displacing and democratizing ownership is a way to slowly get control of this process.
You know, if we had had the credit union model or the Bank of North Dakota model had been basically the rule of thumb for the entire financial sector of the United States, and some variant of that, would it have been less likely we would have had the financial meltdown?
Oh, absolutely. What we know about the Bank of North Dakota, and by the way, 15 other states are considering legislation to set up a state-owned bank like the one that's been in North Dakota for 90 years. It invests locally. It doesn't invest in derivatives. It doesn't speculate. It's oriented to development of the locality. So the models that we're talking about, and I think, you know, we de facto had nationalized several of the major banks. And I think when the next crisis comes, there may be a real nationalization of some of those banks because they're going to produce another major crisis. So at different levels, starting at the local credit union, the local development bank, the local neighborhood financial institutions, building an alternative structure of finance. Many cities, for instance, San Francisco is now considering the following. And again, the press doesn't tell you about this kind of thing, but it's out there, and America Beyond Capitalism and that website, community-wealth, cover it. San Francisco, for instance, they have about $2 billion in tax revenues. Where are they going to place it? They put it in the Bank of America. The Bank of America is going to do whatever it wants with it. So there's a proposal now, set up a city-owned bank or a credit union. Many cities are in exactly the same place. Do your banking and use it as a leverage to have more local development. Co-ops, but also some small businesses to help build the alliance.
Let's take our last caller now. Line one, you're on the air with Professor Garl Purvitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism.
I'm glad you're talking about the financial sector near the end here, because if there's one concrete thing I'd like to see is a true audit of the Fed. But I was wondering, has the professor thought about what's happening in Greece? And I know that's a little bit, you've already bitten off more than enough, but as he looked at what's happening in Greece, and does he have any thoughts about that? Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller.
Well, it's typical. They're squeezing the Greeks in a way that's impossible to solve. I mean, I suspect what they'll ultimately get. I think they want to get them out of the union. They probably will go. But this is a bit. What the really interesting thing from our point of view, is, aside from the pain the Greeks are feeling, is whether or not it begins to pull down some French banks and whether or not it begins to impact some of our own banking system. So it's very dicey in terms of international finance. But I'm afraid if we really went into the Greek situation now, we probably wouldn't have time to do anything else. So I'll just back away from.
Well, you know, unfortunately, we've only got about a minute left, Professor Alperitz. And I want our listeners to know we have touched on maybe 1% of the provocative material in this book about the environment, about the non-sexist city. And I think the most interesting stuff in the book that I hadn't really considered a lot was your whole notion of decentralization as being sort of the foundation of a free economy. Can you just say a word or two about that?
Yeah, if you can't rebuild it in the lives, in the model, in the lives of people in the town of Racine where I come from, if it doesn't make sense and is developed in a way that ordinary people understand it, you haven't got anything that's solid. So decentralization simply means beginning at the community level, also have an authentic and real experience, and begin to show how that develops step by step, either in logic towards a national system.
On that note, I'm afraid I have to cut you off. I hear the band tuning up in the background, Professor Alperovitz. That means they want to get me out of the studio. Garl Alperovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism, thank you so much for taking your time today to join us.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been great, and I want to thank Christina Williams, my producer, Kyle Kroha, my engineer, for their great work this week, and thank you, dear listeners. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back with you in 167 hours. Until then, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The weather forecast, mostly sunny today, becoming windy in the afternoon, winds gusting to 40. Tonight, mostly clear, lows in the upper 20s, the winds die down. Mostly sunny tomorrow, Monday night, mostly clear in the evening, then becoming cloudy. Tuesday, cloudy, there is a 50% chance of light rain.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580.